Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit and creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. His name is Daniel Kamanga, and you're going to love him. This man is, if there was inspiration in the dictionary, you would see his face next to the definition. So he is a businessman and the founder and CEO of the Africa Leadership Transformation Foundation. He has been a journalist. He won journalism awards when he was a teen, and he's just a very, very special guy. So, coming to you from Africa, we have Daniel Kamanga.
Thank you, Hillary. Thank you for the introduction.
So this is, just so you know, the reason why we're smiling, this is our take two, because we had some internet connection problems. So we're just keeping our fingers crossed that this time works. We are across the world from each other, and that's kind of a miracle in and of itself. So, so the last time we were talking about Daniel, and he won a journalism award when he was just a teenager, and then became a journalist for about 10 years. So if you want to just tell them about that award, it's kind of special, and what you wrote on, and that he won a national competition. So he's from Kenya. Nairobi, Kenya. Go ahead. I'll be quiet.
Yeah. Well, that award was very special for me. And it was a competition by the Standard newspaper in Kenya. The Standard newspaper is the oldest newspaper in Kenya. It was started in 1902, and it's still going strong. So when I was a teenager, they ran a competition, and they asked people to write essays about how Kenyan companies can help to employ the disabled. And I don't know what I wrote, and I don't even know whether teenagers should be involved in inquiries like that, but I was top, and I remember the headmaster calling me in assembly, you know, at the front, acknowledging me, going with my dad to collect the award. And of course, my dad giving me some of the money and keeping some of the money for me. And I remember he asked me, what do you want to buy? And I remember I bought a clock so that I could be able to wake up early in the morning. This beautiful clock, a yellow, beautiful clock that would ring and would wake me up so that I can be able to study. And that award became a very important award because my life has been really influenced by those type of things. So when I was in university, I was one of the top three journalists. I was doing a master's in communication, and I was selected by the German organization, three of us, and we went for a tour to Germany. And that was around the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. So we went to Germany, we went to Berlin, and it was just an amazing, you know, and I could tell you so many things that have happened in my life out of things like that. I remember that my first travel out of the country was actually an essay writing competition. I wrote a competition for the Thai embassy, and I was in Thailand for like 2 weeks, you know. So I know that I have a gift in the written word. So it's a signature all over my life. So thank you. Thank you, Hillary, for listening.
Wow. So you just have, I mean, you must just have a gift if you keep winning the competitions, right? Not, I mean, did you try to write, or you just kind of wrote it and there it was winning, you know, like, did you work really hard at it, or did it just flow out?
I think it just flowed.
That's amazing, right?
Yes. When I was younger and I was dating my wife, now we're going to be married for 30 years. I remember I used to write her poetry. I used to write her letters, you know, handwritten letters. It was difficult at the time because, you know, you want to make sure that every I is dotted, every T is crossed. And sometimes when you write by longhand, you know, you'd write and halfway through, you'd make a mistake and you'd have to start all over again. Maybe that was the practice that I needed to be a good writer.
Wow. Well, did it work? Obviously, it worked if she married you, right?
I think it worked, yes.
So, all right. So good. So you have the gift of writing. That's amazing. Okay. So you went to university and you also got a master's in that. Okay.
Yes.
And then you worked for 10 years at the newspaper? Or just in journalism?
Yes. So my first degree was in economics. I did a degree in economics, and then I went back. When I was doing my first degree, I used to write freelance for different newspapers. And so when I finished my first degree, I decided to do a master's in journalism. At that time, they would call it a master's in mass communication. I think it was just a front runner for the social media. So the whole mass communication.
Oh.
Yeah. And then I worked in the media, and I worked in the media for about 10 years. And then I decided to do a master's in business. I was the business editor of the biggest newspaper in Kenya, actually in the region, in East Africa. So I was the business editor. I had worked in different other roles, but this was like my last position before I went to do an MBA in the UK. Yeah.
Wow. And so in our prior version, he had gotten a scholarship and brought his family to the UK from Africa on a scholarship. I mean, that's incredible, right? That you would just do that. So good for you.
Yeah, I was newly married, Hillary, and so my daughter was almost 2 years, and I looked at you know, leaving my wife and my daughter back home in Kenya, and I thought the right decision was to be with them in the UK. Difficult though the life was, and you know, because you know, the stipend was not for a married person; it was for a single person. So I had to of course get a house where we could live and really be together with my wife and my daughter.
Yeah, so you did it. You got your degree, right, and then you went back. Then you went to South Africa, right? And you started working with a couple of different companies, right? Financial services, telecom, and then you went to the agricultural sector, correct?
Actually, what happened was that my first, you know, when I came to South Africa, I worked in the media briefly, helped produce, a friend of mine was doing a very specialized publications. I did some work for him, and then I got employed in the financial services sector. So I worked in the financial services sector for some time, and then I left to join the telecoms industry. And I can share the story of how I joined the telecoms industry. And after working in the telecoms industry, I then worked in the agricultural sector. And we worked, you know, in the agricultural sector, I worked for almost 15 years, because by the time I resigned to set up the Leadership Foundation, it was about almost 16 years in the ag sector.
Wow. Mm. And what were you doing in that sector? What kind of work were you doing?
So in the ag sector, we, you know, so I was working with a very accomplished scientist, and my primary focus, I was the director of communications. This organization was a U.S. Registered nonprofit organization. So I was the director of communication. I was dealing with a lot with fundraising. We had a strong communication component, fundraising, government liaison, dealing with that type of work. That was really what I was doing. And we had a great run. We did huge projects, multi-million-dollar projects funded by almost most of the people funding projects in Africa. And then I got to a place where I began to think about what was missing for me And what is still missing for me is leadership. And I saw the need to transform leadership. And it took me a while to really get everything together, to be focused on this area, which is really for me the love of my life, and which is really what I've given my life to at the moment.
Now, what was the purpose of the agricultural company that you saw? So what was the purpose of that? And how did you see that leadership was missing?
So the agricultural, agriculture for me was the fact that a lot of people on the continent are involved in agriculture in one way or the other.
Okay.
I always say that if you are in Kenya, for example, and you saw the rain, there was good rains, you could go to the stock market and invest and make a lot of money. Why? Because agriculture influences everything, from the financial services to tourism, to telecom. So being in the agricultural sector was, for me, a very, very important opportunity to be able to work with in a sector where that influences majority of the people on the continent.
And why? Just, you know, coming from the U.S., we're not, you know, where I am, it's not agricultural oriented. Is it because everything is farming? Like, why is the agriculture so, why, like this, how can it affect the stock market?
Yeah, well, the thing is that even in the U.S. and in the Western world, there was a time that those economies were driven largely by agriculture. Right. So generally for an economy, a country must first of all take care of its food needs and self-sufficiency and maybe export the extra. So the U.S. has done extremely well in the agricultural sector because of mechanization, of the investment that the government made in the early days. So the U.S. produces more food than they need, which has been a really game changer. So I think Africa is in that stage where, of course, if you look at the contribution of agriculture to the GDP in a place like South Africa, which is a much more mature economy, agriculture is much less. But in most of the African economies, many farmers are subsistence farmers. They're doing subsistence farming, which is really surviving, having some food to eat. There's some commercial farming, but it's such an important sector that almost all African countries will have a minister in charge of agriculture.
Wow. Okay. So it's really subsistence to survive. They're farming to survive. It's not as a business, right?
Well. There is commercial farming. There is commercial farming, but majority of the farmers are probably poor. They don't have a tractor, so they're just planting enough for them to eat. So anybody who is doing anything on the continent and you're not in agriculture, you know, you'll find that in a way that there's a connection between what most people are doing and the agricultural sector.
Okay. So then where did you see the lack of leadership? I mean, were you always passionate about leadership, or did it develop during this time, do you think?
I didn't see it as leadership at the time I was involved in the agricultural sector.
Okay.
So in the agricultural sector, the conversations normally are, oh, we need better seeds. And it is true that people need better seeds, hybrid seeds. And sometimes people will say, oh, we need mechanization. And it is true that people need mechanization. Or we need better functioning markets. So for me, it was never the issue of we need more leadership or more quality leadership. But I could see that a lot of money had been invested in better markets, better seed system, more research, but very little was in the leadership area. And I remember that when I did the Being a Leader course in Abu Dhabi, that's when the bulb went on. And I was like, oh my God, leadership is what is missing in the agricultural sector. And then the more I looked at leadership, the more I realized that it was missing everywhere. And I thought, if we could invest in leadership, if we could transform leadership, we could transform the continent. So I saw that there were two problems. One problem was where leadership existed, it was probably dysfunctional or needed to be transformed. And there's a very distinct way we talk about transformation. The other thing was that often leadership was missing entirely. So we needed to bring in leadership. And so that's what I saw. And I thought, you know, you would find, for example, you'll find almost all the big funders to the African continent, the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, USAID, most of them have got programs where they are funding specific things in agriculture or in other sectors, whether it's climate change. But very few of them are really funding leadership. I've spoken to some of my friends in some of these organizations and in the sector and saying, if you have a $10 million agricultural budget for a certain country, if you took just 0.5 or 1 or 10% of that and said, I'm going to go after leadership, you would find that your return on that investment would go exponentially. And I talk about leadership across the board. So leadership from the recipients of whatever it is that you are doing, leadership at the people who are funding, they need some kind of leadership that will be able to unlock value of what it is that, whether you're doing seed systems, whether you're doing markets, whether you are doing research, whatever it is that you're doing, leadership is integral to transforming the continent.
Wow. So, okay. So let's take the seeds. They're putting millions into that. Okay. If instead they invested in the leadership, how would that make the seed program better? You know what I mean? More effective, more return.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like, tell me if I'm paraphrasing wrong, they're kind of throwing away their money right now to a certain extent.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. I would say that it's not an either or. And I would be the last person to make wrong what many of these amazing organizations are doing. They're doing amazing work. Okay. All I'm saying that what's missing is in the leadership area. Let's take, for example, seed systems. Okay. Now, in the seed systems, there are a lot of different conversations in the seed systems. The first thing is, do we have the right seed varieties for the climate, for the soils? So that's a whole conversation on seed. Now, to have that conversation, you need the conversation of the seed companies. You need conversations of the farmers who are using those seeds. You need conversations with the government that is involved in the agricultural sector. You need conversations with donors. You need conversations with research organizations. What does all this have to do with leadership? One of the things that I saw, and it's really frustrating for me, is that there's an element of short-termism. So a problem comes up, and now we need to get seeds to everybody. So everybody is now thinking about seeds. But leadership doesn't work that way. Leadership looks at what I would call the long path. In research, they've said long path is when you say, where do we need to get the agricultural sector in this country in the next 50 years, in the next 100 years? That's how you work. It depends from where are you looking. So when you're looking at transforming the agricultural sector from 100 years, what you see is very different from looking at what do we need to do now that we don't have seeds. So you're in all this hamster wheel and dealing with those kind of issues. So there's no leadership taking place. So leadership is creating a future that would happen, a future that would not happen unless it is created. So when you bring leadership, everything changes. Everything changes. So at the moment, I think a lot of the interventions, the development interventions, are very, very, very short term. So if you look in the development sector, many funders fund 2-year projects, 3-year projects, 4-year projects. They might fund 3-year projects and fund another extension for 3-year projects. Now, if you're funding an agricultural project, how would you fund a project for 3 years? What would you achieve in 3 years in an agricultural project? You have got maybe 1 or 2 seasons of rain. So really, you find that there's something missing in terms of how we are doing development when leadership is missing.
Now, would you say it's they're reacting versus like they're being reactive versus proactive, or not really?
Not really. There is a place for reactive. For example, if right now in my own country, Kenya, we have had floods. A lot of people are dying because of the flooding. You need to react to the situation. Now, but if you are reacting to the situation, you need to also have a long-term planning and say, now, this is what has happened now. What if in another 10 years, the amount of rain is three times as much? What do we then need to do in the long term? So some of these things, we experience them because of the short-term nature of how we are intervening in challenges. Yes.
So when you're saying leadership, I know there's more aspects of leadership, but what I've heard so far you say is that leaders would plan for a longer period of time, not just look at a 2 or 3 year, but really 100 years or 10 years or 25 years or something. And that's what you are looking to create, more people thinking that way.
Yes.
So how did you start? So you were working in agriculture, you saw the need for leadership, and then you wanted to transform leadership. You took the Be a Leader course, and then what did you do?
Well, at first, I took a stand for getting the Being a Leader course on the African continent. And, based on that stand, worked with several universities and sure enough brought the continent the course on the continent. In actual fact, the course continues to really benefit many people on the continent. But then I expanded my thinking from where I was looking from, and I saw that this is beyond doing a leadership course in a university. And the Being a Leader course, being a leader course is an excellent course, but I saw some very serious challenges. For example, in the middle of COVID, I was reading a lot of papers on the impact of COVID on women, and I was kind of horrified by some of these things. I said, obviously, it's a leadership challenge. So there were two challenges that I saw. I'll give you an example. One of the issues that I saw was that the issue of frontline workers in the Western world. So in the Western world, the issue of frontline workers was medical workers, people who are working in hospitals, helping in these areas. But I thought, like in Africa, the frontline workers were actually people working in churches, in the mosques, so if something happened and somebody was sick, they would go to a pastor and say, look, so and so is sick. So the pastor would have to go and pray with them. And if somebody died, the pastor would have to bury them. If they didn't have food, they would go to the pastor. They would ask, we don't have food. What are you going to do? So I kind of coined this whole idea that Africa's frontline workers were people in ministry, in churches. So I said, what kind of leadership do we need for those type of frontline workers? And we developed a program to support them, because if you're a pastor, you have not been trained on dealing with some of the issues that society is going to throw at you. So we started a program which we call it's a certificate. We give a certificate. It's a certificate in leadership for faith change makers. So we began to train them in how do you work with street children and make a massive intervention? How do you work with the elderly and make a massive intervention? How do you work with teenage mothers and make a great intervention? So that was one of the things that led us to start building leadership in that whole area. When it comes to the issue of women, sorry, go ahead.
How did you do that? Did you just create a course and go grab the ministers and put them in a room? Like, how did you actually make that happen? Do you know what I mean? It's that you're making it sound so easy, and maybe it was, but you had an idea, and then this is just for other people who have ideas. And what did you do to make this happen so fast?
So when I saw that, I was speaking with a lot of people who are already involved in this. And I spoke to several pastors. I spoke to several people working in, I spoke to some people who say, you know, God called me to work with street children. I say, oh, God called you. Oh, wow, that's interesting. So I wonder why God has not called people to work with the elderly who are dying and things like that. Then, you know, having conversations, so I realized that maybe God called somebody and the person didn't do what he's supposed to do. You know, so we began to have these kind of conversations. And we said, maybe God is calling people and people are not hearing or they're not answering. How can we help them? And we thought about all the people who go to church and Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, they sit, they listen, they sit, they listen. Like, what are you for? I mean, there are so many problems to be resolved, you know. So like, you know, so we began to have a joke about how the spiritual obesity, you know, on the continent was huge. So people had, they knew so much, they had so much of God, but they were not expressing God in the various areas. So we thought, could we get together a course? And so I called a few of my friends. We put together some friends and we began having conversations about, could we do a course on this? And of course, we began to sketch what would the modules be? Who would run it? And then, so we said, maybe you should do a course on meditation for faith change makers. Maybe you should do a course on, how do you create meaning out of what it is that you are doing. And we got somebody from New Zealand to do a whole module on meaning for faith change makers. So we have 7 modules. And then we approached some university, an Anglican university from the Episcopal Church in Malawi. Mm-hmm. And they were excited. They were like, this is exactly what we need to do. We approached another organization and eventually we had a course. We tested it. And we are doing going to be doing the 6th course sometime in July this year. Our goal is by the end of this year, we'll have probably about 1,000 faith change makers trained in that course. I just love the course. It's such a great course. We have people who are doing amazing stuff who are graduates of the course.
Wow.
There's one lady who's working with adolescents in Uganda. There's a guy in Malawi who's working with the elderly. So we kind of like get people to work.
And what do you think is the piece that, you know, you say from spiritual obesity, like, yes, praying in church, la, 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 to now taking action? What do you think was the piece that switched?
I think that especially within the Christian faith, I think many people are waiting kind of to hear the audible voice of God. Like, Mr. Kamanga, I'm calling you to go. So even the work that we are doing in leadership, I believe that this is God's call on my life. Now, mm-hmm. I have this whole idea that if God called you to do, if you're not doing what God called you to do, I think God is so big, he can tell you, hey, Mr. Kamanga, not that one, move this way. So, yeah. So I'm really for people getting their hands dirty. See what you can do with what you have and start.
But something in that course got them to get, let's just say, off their butts. Like, yes. Something, you know, do you have any idea? Or maybe you reached into their heart or you... I don't think you shamed them, but I think, I mean, because I see it, you know, when people want to do something, but it's like maybe they didn't even want to do it. They were just lazy. Maybe they were just comfortable. And this got them to tune into some other place, like maybe their heart, and get them going.
Let me tell you a story. There was a conversation we were having. There was a lady who had been working in prison with prisoners for 14 years from the UK. She's from Zambia. And then there was a lady from South Africa who had always wanted to work in prison ministries, but had never done anything about it. So we're having this conversation, and this lady is saying how she has lived a life of fulfillment working with people in prisons. And then this other lady says, oh my God, this is what God told me to do 14 years ago. So it's almost like when that lady didn't obey God, if you want to put it that way, God got somebody else to do it. Now, I can't prove to you that that's what happened. But in this conversation, this lady really got that. I know that God called me to do this. But I was like, I don't have this. I don't have that. I don't have that. I don't have that. This other lady, when God called her, she just took off. She said, well, yeah. I can buy some apples and go to a prison and be the prisoners. You know, I don't need to have like $1 million. Now, of course, you can create a program that becomes very large, but nobody starts that way. Yeah.
So, yeah, I see. No, that's a great example. So did the second woman then go with her and start working in the prisons?
She didn't go with her, but she got really clear, and other people got clear. So most Christians know that the whole life of faith is a life of service. Mm. Yeah, they know that innately, and most people can say, you know what, I've been disobedient. So it's easy to get people to see that I ought to be doing something with my life. I ought to be serving somewhere. You know, I always give the example of Mother Teresa. You know, I mean, she's an icon of service, but she started with one or two street children. You know, now there are so many orphanages all over the world, but it had to start with one child, one street child. Bring that one in. So that's how it starts. There's no other way.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. So it seems like, you know, you're getting them in a conversation, you're opening their eyes and you're having them see it doesn't have to be a big deal. Just take an action. Just take a small action. And that's the beginning, right?
Yeah. And, you know, on the African continent, I mean, I always say that we are so lucky because we have problems all around us.
There's no shortage. I mean, no shortage.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't need to look a lot. Maybe in the US or Europe, you might struggle with what do you do. But on the African continent, just walk out of the street and there are people who are looking for jobs. Mm. You know, grown men sitting under a tree. You know, you could start. One lady came to one of our courses. She's a refugee girl. She came to the course and she was like, oh my God, I can change the other girl's life. She started by calling a few girls to sit under a tree and saying, tell me the problems you have. This is a question most of these girls, nobody had ever asked them that kind of question. Mm. Yeah. And she started making a difference with 3, 4, 5 girls. They would say how they were sexually abused. They would say how they're having depression. They would say all these kind of things. It started by somebody saying, I don't have money. I don't have any, but I have my mouth and I can sit under a tree. And she's making a difference, a refugee girl. Wow. In fact, she became so good at what she was doing. Somebody asked her, like, where did you learn all this? And then they gave her a job somewhere in the camp, in the refugee camp. So she now has a job out of serving other people.
Wow.
That's the leadership that's missing. Not the leadership that of, you know, you're in a big air-conditioned office. Right. It's important to have that. But we are really about democratizing leadership and getting leadership to those people who need it the most.
Mm. All right.
Yes.
Hold that thought. I'm writing that down. We're going to go to our commercial break with our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more from Daniel Kamenga. Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Hikori to your school.
Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, thank you as always to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential, social, emotional learning to your schools, businesses, even to Africa, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule time to talk to them. They have amazing activities that get you connected, feeling social, having kids belong, and getting back to where they should be if it wasn't for COVID. Also, as you saw in my commercial, here's my book, Real Talk. If you have areas where you're not speaking up, where you're afraid, you don't think you can, give me a call. We will get you free to creating that life you love and have you saying all those things you think about, but just don't think can come out of your mouth. You can go to Hillary@gettingrealwithhillary.com and tell me you want to have a conversation. And all right, now we're going to hear more from this wonderful Daniel Kamenga. Wow. You make it sound so easy what you're doing. And I know maybe it was, but whew. So, all right. You're the founder and CEO of the Africa Leadership Transformation Foundation. Is that what this was with the ministry, the Faith Change Makers, or is that part of it? Is that where you started and then it evolved?
It's part of it. The vision of the our foundation is transforming leadership as the key to an Africa that works for everyone. So we're in the business of transforming leadership. That means where leadership exists, we look at that leadership and see, is there a need to transform that leadership? And where leadership is absent, how can we create leadership that is transformed, leadership that can actually make the lives of people better? And to that end, our goal is to have 1 million leaders in 10 African countries by 2050. So we actually started with a women's program in the middle of COVID. So what happened was that, as I said earlier, there were a lot of challenges with women. The statistics were horrendous in terms of what was going on. And just similar to the Faith Change Makers course, we brought together several women and we began a conversation. In actual fact, we brought 5 women. We brought a woman from the US, we brought a woman from France, we brought a woman from Kenya, we brought a woman from South Africa, and we brought a woman from Nigeria. And we began to say, if we were to have a course that would support women, what kind of course would we have? This is where we started.
So, Now, was that the one with Eileen? I keep waiting for that one. Was that the one?
Yes, it was. It was with Eileen Epperson, who did a module on forgiveness. Yes, and we had somebody else in France do a module on resilience, you know. And we worked over almost 6 months with each of those women. And then we got the women together, conversations. And then we created the modules. And then we had a lady from Nigeria. We said, you know, most women will never get a therapist. But given the issues they face, what do we then do if they don't get a therapist? Can't they be their own therapists? You know, so we had all these kind of crazy questions. And she said, well, we can teach the women to tap, you know, to you know, they call it EFT. So she would teach on how to very, very, so if you are going through a very, she would be on Zoom and ask somebody, if you are going through a very difficult situation on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being you're okay and 10 being you're very bad, and somebody would put up their hand and they would be on a 9, and she would work with them. And we still have this, she would work with them. And at the end of it, while all the other women would be on the course, and at the end of the course, invariably, in every situation, they would drop from a 9 and come back to a 6 or a 5 or even a 3 and get that cleared, just in that moment of conversation and what they were being taught. So so we then created a prototype course, and we had 77 women come on the course. So we are just about
to Zoom. Was it on Zoom?
It was on Zoom.
Okay.
Yeah. And it is still on Zoom, yes.
Okay. Mm. So, okay. So 77. So that was your first thing. When was that? What year was that?
I could be wrong. It must have been 2021.
Okay. So 3 years ago. And then from there, so that was how you started with the women. And from there, you took that course. And how many times have you done it?
We're going to be on the, you're going to be on the 8th course in July.
Wow. Mm. And so what have been the results from the women? I know you had talked about the refugees, single mother. That was one group, right, that made a huge difference from this course?
Yeah. So mm-hmm. the results have been just amazing. You know, we've got probably going to about 100 volunteers working in this work, and we have about 1,000 women who have gone, actually more than 1,000 women who have gone through the course, graduates of the course. Out of the initial course leaders, we now have a whole new faculty of course leaders. We have a very healthy pipeline of women who want to be course leaders for different modules. So we train other women to be course leaders, and I think one of the most interesting things which we are now looking at is we are still in the game of having 1 million leaders trained in 10 African countries by 2050. So while we are very happy that we have got about 1,000 women who've been trained, and we can probably train probably 1,000 every year, that won't get us to the million or to the 500,000 women trained by 2050. So we are looking at how do we massively scale that up? So that's a conversation that we are going on now. And we have got, we are looking at possibility of having national programs. So the women are leading, you know, different countries. So at the end of the day, the big challenge is the interventions, you know, so the challenges that women face on the African continent and globally, they cannot be solved on a small scale. They have to be solved at scale. So that's really the game that we want to play. But you can't have a conversation of scale before you refine your game at the level of about 1,000. So we have looked at what we are doing right and what we need to learn with a view to really scaling up this exponentially.
Wow. And question, originally you were talking about leadership. Now you're talking about women. When did you switch from leadership? To me, that includes everybody, to focus on women. Can you just say how that came about?
So the Africa Women Leadership and Mental Wellbeing course, that's the title of that course. So it's a leadership course that includes mental well-being. And it was our first course. And the reason why it was our first course, we saw that the challenge of women leadership and mental well-being was huge and remains huge. I mean, the conversations on if you are in one of our courses, you'd probably feel like there's some therapy going on. There are women who have come overwhelmed by their circumstances and probably wanting to commit suicide. And in a breakaway room, in a conversation, they get clear that their commitment is to be alive for themselves, for their children, for their husbands, for their families. So it's that type of a course. So it's a very, very powerful course. There are people who are therapists and psychologists who have come on the course, and they've been surprised that something like that actually exists. So we've been surprised ourselves because, you know, when you create a course, you kind of have this mentality that I'm going to go out there and teach people about this and about that. And actually what has happened is that, for example, the women from the refugee camps have taught all of us things that we could never have been able to truly understand. So when they have conversations on forgiveness as refugee women, it's a whole different conversation that you come into the classroom with. So the whole thing has changed from teaching women about leadership. And now our focus is actually more calling forth the leadership of women that is already there in them. The African women, they are already, you know, it's actually calling forth the resilience of the African women. Mm. I'll give you just one simple example. The lady who teaches on resilience normally asks the women a question. How many of you have ever had a situation whereby maybe there is no food in the house and somehow you manage to get something and people ate for that night and almost all the hands go up? So African women will find a way of doing things like it's almost, or how many of you needed to go for a job interview, but you didn't have your hair made up and you found a way of, you know, getting your hair in a style and people are like, wow, like, how did you do that? You know, so this type of resilience really resonates with the women. So we are not teaching. That's why we talk about course leaders. We are leading, we are drawing out the resilience. We are drawing out the leadership, the leadership out of the women in this particular course. Yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't want to get us off track, but I keep thinking, what about the men? Is it because the women will impact the men? That's why you're focusing on the women. By creating women leaders, it will impact everybody. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could just have a leadership corp for anybody, but you're focusing on women. I mean, I understand the need, but it's like, is that because they'll impact the rest? I mean, I'm just wondering. And it, you know,
not really. I think when we had the conversation with the women, the questions we were asking, women are facing all these myriads of challenges.
Okay.
Can we come up with a course that gets them clear, that resolves the issues?
Yeah.
And gets them to begin to really be powerful to do what they need to do. This was a question we were responding to when we came up with the course. Now, I would say that even after doing the course, there's still a lot that the women need. Some people say, oh, maybe you need to help us to run our small business and things like that. And our response is there are so many organizations doing those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
Our argument is that many organizations are going to help teenage mothers to create a livelihood, to do this, to do that, and that's needed. But that teenage mother probably got pregnant through sexual abuse. That issue remains unresolved, even as she needs to handle the issue of livelihood. But if you could resolve, because it's unseen, it's much more difficult to resolve. So the course comes in to resolve those issues, fully aware that there are other things that the women need. So now I know that I've asked, many people ask the question, why not men? I think that if you look at, if you are a businessman or businesswoman, and you looked at investing in leadership for women, the return on investment on your investment would be highest for women. Because when you invest in leadership for a woman, the impact is exponential. There's her children. She shows up in life differently. That doesn't mean that there's need for leadership programs, similar programs for men. And we have not ruled out the possibility that we could do one. But we are already kind of overwhelmed by the need for leadership for women.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and it seems like there's a lot of issues, yeah, that you're solving. So, wow. Whew, amazing. Amazing work. What would you say, I know you have your goal of the million leaders in 10 countries. What would you want the impact, or what are you looking for from viewers, people watching? How can they help you? And what is your vision for Africa, the world?
So, yeah, I would want viewers to really get that leadership is so critical. When we work with refugee, we've worked with about 200 refugee women. There is nothing like a refugee woman going through the course. She still needs to feed her family. She still needs a livelihood. But where we leave that woman is a totally different place from where she was. So I would want the viewers to really be able to see that leadership is such a critical component of intervention in development, in the challenges of human beings. And sometimes when somebody is in a difficult place, the tendency is to solve their problem or help solve their problem. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't solve their problem, but perhaps an intervention that is sustainable and more long-term is helping them to see that they have the capacity and the agency to be able to solve their own problem. So that's the first thing that, you know, I could come here and say, you know what, you know, if we got more money, we would train more refugee women. And that's true. But I would want to ensure that those people who support us don't support us. We are not coming here to say we are needy or finances are, you know, if you don't give us money, we won't do this. No. We'll continue doing it with whatever we have. But, you know, it's very, very important to see that if you put $250 to train maybe 10 women in the refugee camp, I want you to get that $250 has such a huge impact, And people who have gotten this find it very easy to support the work that we are doing. So I would want people to really get that that leadership is really, really critical. And when you transform somebody's life to a place where they're like, they're not even asking you for food, they're not even asking you for those things which they need, that's a transformation that is very, very powerful.
Wow. So let's say somebody wanted to donate the $250, how would they do that?
So on our website, we have a donate button. You can go on our website. I'm sure you have the website on the show.
Yeah, I'll put it on the notes, but what, can you just say it? Yeah, go ahead. What's the website?
It's ALT. Yeah, okay. It's ALT Foundation. ALTFoundation.Africa. Okay. ALTFoundation.Africa. Yes.
Okay. So if anybody wants to donate, even $250, ALTFoundation.Africa. Okay, great. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And thank you for that. And it seems like, you know, there's a lot of things wrapped up when you say leadership. It means hope. It means resilience. It means forgiveness. It means reaching in to get their strength, so that they don't want to just give up because it's too hard. And so just, you know, thank you for all of that. If you could have your ideal situation, let's say 5 years, 10 years, how would you know, and I know the million leaders, but besides that, just in your heart, how would you see the world 5-10 years?
Well, I'm already on the way to not being such a critical person in the women's cause. The women's cause can run without me. So if you ask me in 5 years, I would want to have built teams of people who are so that the system is self-replicating, and there are structures that are ongoing. And in 5 years, I would definitely want us to be really on track to a million leaders. I would want to be to have a clear pathway that this is happening. We are on track for a million leaders. So I think that right now we have been very lucky to achieve what we have been able to achieve. We feel so lucky. We think that it's been a great achievement, but we think we have only just scratched the surface. There's a lot to learn from. There's a lot to do. And in 5 years, I would love to really have the systems on full operation, moving forward towards a million leaders in Africa, in 10 African countries.
Okay. And like in three words, if you could, or five, let's say you have those million leaders. How do you see Africa? What are some words to describe the Africa of a million leaders?
Joyful, creative, resilience, and contributing to the rest of the world.
Wow. Thank you.
Most of all, not dependent. The people knowing that they have an agency in their lives, and they are not helpless. No human being is helpless. Yes.
How about powerful?
Powerful. Yes.
Yes.
Powerful. Beautiful. I love it.
All right. So, yeah. Cheers to a powerful Africa. Yeah. Thank you, yes. Daniel. Thank you so much for your work, for your selflessness, for your contribution, for the difference you make. Thank you for listening
to
God.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to God. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hello.
It's really appreciated.
Hello. Thank you.
I'm here.
I'm here too. Yes. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.